All right, we've got another fascinating interview for you guys here on TYT Interviews. We're going to talk to Professor Stephen Cohen. He's a professor of Russian studies and history at New York University. He spent 30 years at Princeton and then moved on to NYU. He's written books such as Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives, From Stalinism to the New Cold War. I was on the precipice of writing that book myself, but he beat me to it. Similarly with Bukharin and Bolshevik Revolution, A Political Biography, 1888 to 1938, that is among a great number of books that he's written on Russia. One of the reasons that we have him on here is because he's going to give us a different perspective. Some in the audience criticized, honestly, the Young Turks for having a too pro-Ukrainian bent, and we want to talk to someone who is an expert on the matter and knows Russia intimately. He's friends with Mikhail Gorbachev, of all people, and he recently interviewed Edward Snowden in Russia for The Nation magazine. So certainly the right expert for this. Professor Cohen, thank you for joining us on The Young Turks. We appreciate it.
Is it true that The Young Turks have a young audience?
It is indeed. The average age of our audience is 28 years old.
Well, this is a good thing then, because my students and my children often ask me, what was it like during the Cold War? And now all your listeners and viewers get to find out for themselves, because we're in one again.
Oh, wow, that's interesting. Yeah, so I read that you said this is the most dangerous time for Russian-U.S. relations since the Cuban Missile Crisis. So that's a huge statement. So first, let's start there. Why do you think we're in that degree of danger?
Well, the first time I said that, I may have written it in The Nation magazine, but the first time I said that in a broadcast fashion was on CNN, and they didn't invite me back. But events have unfolded about the way I foresaw back in February when this crisis, the dimensions of the crisis were clear. Let me say what I think has happened. This is not an editorial opinion. This is fact. About a year ago, in November of 2013, in Kiev, there was a political dispute as to whether the corrupt but popularly elected, legitimately elected president of Ukraine should sign an economic association agreement with the European Union. And when he decided not to, as you remember, protests formed in the streets, and they became violent in February. Molotov cocktails, snipers, barricades, lots of violence. And the president fled, and then came a civil war in Ukraine, because it is a divided country. It's a country historically divided. It's a country pieced together by remnants of history going back to the 17th and 18th century. Parts of Ukraine were parts of different empires. People have somewhat different religions and languages, social attitudes. So a civil war between Kiev and the eastern part of the country began. Now, Russia abetted this civil war, but it didn't create it. The civil war then became a proxy war between the United States and Russia, with the United States supporting, as we do today, Vice President Biden is racking up a lot of frequent flyer miles. He's been there, I think, four times this year. Don't know what he's doing there, but he's there a lot. Proxy war between the United States, which is supporting Kiev, and Russia, which is supporting the rebellious eastern provinces. And so that flung us back into this new Cold War. And it's a classic Cold War. People who deny it because they got us into it, and they don't want to admit it. Or they said it wasn't possible. Now the question is, not only can we cut this Cold War short, or will this Cold War, considering that Ukraine is right on Russia's borders, you remember Berlin, the center of the last Cold War, was far away, will this Cold War result in a hot war between the United States and Russia? And because we are now eyeball to eyeball, the Cuban Missile Crisis comes to mind, where we had that moment when we were eyeball to eyeball and wise leadership found a way out. It's not clear we have wise leadership today, so that's why I use the analogy of the Cuban Missile Crisis.
So, Professor Cohen, you know, at the time it was clear that the protesters were at times throwing Molotov cocktails, et cetera. But also the police reaction seemed to have been an overreaction. And both sides claim the snipers were from the other side. And so that's a mess, and honestly, I don't know how to sort that out, right? But when
right.
when you look at the macro picture, when you see what Russia did in Georgia, what you see, you know, how they basically took Crimea here, it does seem that, at least to the naked eye and to me, that Russia appears to be the aggressor in that sense. Do you disagree with that? Do you think we're seeing it wrong?
Well, you know, President Reagan, I didn't vote for him, but he did say one thing that was very wise. He said, when it comes to America and then Soviet Russia, it takes two to tango. You know, Reagan came out of Hollywood, and he tended to speak in these Hollywood truisms, but some truisms are two. Both sides are complicit in this. The notion that's around that people say, I'm a Putin apologist, all that kind of slander, is not true. I understand fully well that both sides are complicit. But I would not formulate it the way it's being formulated and the way you did, that this is a result of Russian or Putin's aggression. I would put it differently. Ever since the United States began, and it was hotly disputed at the time, there was a debate here, I participated in it in the 1990s, to expand NATO ever closer to Russia's borders. Now, let's be clear what that means. That means NATO took in all the countries from Germany all the way to the Baltics, the little small Baltic republics, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, which are on Russia's borders, as well as Poland, which is almost on Russia's borders. Russia has seen this, and not unreasonably, as a form of Western aggression, moving a military alliance ever closer to it. That's been going on for nearly 20 years. The Georgian War, which was a proxy war, but you remember we created the Georgian Army. Saakashvili, who now lives in Brooklyn in disgrace and is under indictment in Georgia, was an American client. He killed Russian peacekeepers, and he attacked a province of Georgia that was on Russia's borders, South Ossetia. He killed Russian citizens, and Russia came into the country. So Russia sees itself sinned upon, aggressed upon. Now go to Ukraine. There is absolutely no doubt, factual doubt, that what the European Union tried to impose on the elected president of Ukraine in November 2013 was not only an economic agreement, but the 1,000-page protocol included a section called Military and Security Issues. And though the name, the word NATO was not mentioned, Russia has lawyers, and they can read between the lines. And that meant adherence to NATO policy. When the Ukrainian government fell in February, and a very radical, and I wouldn't even call it pro-Western, part of it was pro-Western, but some of these guys in Ukraine are something else altogether. You would not have them to dinner. You would not like them to govern any country you lived in. When Moscow saw this, it thought these people were headed for Crimea, which has been a Russian province historically, culturally, for centuries. It was an accident. It was in the territory of Ukraine. And so they annexed it, or as they say, we reunited with Crimea. But if you look at this, no reasonable person would say that Putin has done much more than react. Now, we could debate whether he's reacted wisely. I would concede he's not been wise. I would have preferred that he not annex Crimea, but offer an internationally supervised referendum. That's, you know, that happens in lots of countries.
Mm-hmm.
But the point here is that in his mind, he did nothing more and something more legitimate and virtuous than what we did when we took Kosovo away from Serbia. That we set the precedent in modern times. But the essential point, if we care about the security of our country and the world, is that Putin has reacted. And when Putin goes into reaction, it's tough. And he doesn't back down. And that's why I say it's a very dangerous moment right now. Because we are building up the military in Kiev, which has been assaulting the eastern provinces for almost a year. And Putin said in a television interview to Germany about 3 weeks ago. What is our red line? We will not let them kill our Russian-speaking brethren in Donbass. That's the center of this eastern Ukrainian part, where the war is now focused. I think that's true. That's his red line, and yet we keep pushing. My perspective is we brought this on ourselves with an unwise policy that was begun 20 years ago. Some of us warned about it, including the late George Kennan, who was considered a very wise American on Russian affairs. But lots of us warned about it, and Clinton pressed ahead, Bush pressed ahead, Obama pressed ahead. They didn't heed it, and now they've reaped what they sowed, and it's convenient for them to say it's all Putin's fault. Let me add one thing, because this is a generational perspective. I'm old enough to have lived through this public media issue back in the 1970s and 80s. It was called detente versus Cold War then. At that time, the American mainstream media was amply full of both points of view. It is not today. The American mainstream media is one hand clapping. And I mean the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, ABC, NBC, PBS, all the cable channels. They are giving one narrative of the history of this dispute, this crisis, this new Cold War. And it's a false narrative because half of the story is omitted. And the old American adage that I was raised on, that there are two sides to every story, or live by the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And when you say, well, the Russians are hypersensitive and they shouldn't take this so seriously, let's remember the Cuban Missile Crisis. We nearly went to nuclear war on the grounds that Russia could not have a base 90 miles off the shore of Miami. So we play by a double standard. And as Putin said a few weeks ago at a place called Valdai, where he gave an amazing speech that absolutely nobody paid any attention to in the United States, he said, this story is over. We have nowhere to retreat to. We're not backing off. So this should be taken seriously. But I would say to your younger audience, which, like my children, don't read traditional media anymore. Watch it. That they're on the internet. When I told Snowden, when my wife said to Snowden in Moscow, do you watch television? He said, what's television? He said, it's obsolete technology. Your people, your audience, can go to the internet, they understand it, in ways that I cannot. And they should no longer be dependent on the American mainstream media. That is the only hope for this generation, because the mainstream media has betrayed us. They have not told the full story.
So when you talk about the mainstream media and how they only tell one side of the story, you're speaking our language, and I'm very open to that. And you know, you mentioned your wife there. She was part of the interview with Edward Snowden. People should know it's Katrina Vandenhoevel, who's the editor of The Nation. You guys interviewed Snowden together. And so I'm open to what you're saying there. And the idea that people call you, my favorite word, they call you a toady of Putin. I find that hilarious. If you just present the other side, you must, by definition, be on the other side. No, that's not the case. And I hear you presenting a balanced case today here, and one that we don't often hear in the media, and I'm very appreciative of that. But nonetheless, when I look at some of the facts here, I'm not sure that I completely agree. And so let's hash that out. Let's have a conversation about it. So
Before we do that, let's say two things, or let me say two things. When we began the conversation, I don't fault you for this, but you began by saying something like, well, what are we going to do about Russian aggression? You've picked that up from the news sources you use. That's language. That's a narrative. But if the Russians see us as aggressing upon them, then the way to formulate it would be to ask me, both sides seem to see the other aggressing upon it. What are we going to do about that? Then we're entering into the real world. The other thing is, if somebody called you a toady, a traitor, a Putin apologist, on a regular basis, you wouldn't think it's hilarious. I mean, I shrug it off because I've seen it before. But these are people with absolutely no credentials. They are the hacks that populate this internet journalism now. They just like to generate heat, name-calling. But they know nothing about Russia. They know nothing about Ukraine. They know nothing about the crisis that's underway in Europe. They don't even know how policy is made in Washington. They don't know any history. They don't know how this all began. So if I say, as I did on CNN and in my wife's magazine, The Nation, there's two sides to this story, their answer is, he's Putin's toady. I mean, why am I? I mean, what that means, I don't even know what a toady is. But we know what they want to say.
Right. Now, look.
By the way, I mean, one person, only one person, has engaged my argument without calling me names. And that is a mature man who was a former American ambassador to Ukraine at the Brookings Institution. And he said I was entirely wrong. But he laid out the facts as he understood them and the faults in my logic, and that's good. That's right. Called democratic debate.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Look, I think on the issue of framing, the first one you brought up, you're completely right. I not only get that from the news sources, which is true, but I believe that to some degree, and that's the conversation we're about to have. But on the second point, I laugh at these insults only because, Professor Cohen, on this one I have more experience than you do. I might be the most...
Well, didn't you once have a television show on it, a cable station we won't mention, and you got bumped because you were crossing everybody else's lines?
Well, that's exactly what happened. And
well, so you know what it's about. I mean, this...
And I might be the most insulted man on the internet. So Toadie's the least of it when they come to calling me names. So I'm right there with you, brother. Okay, so now let's get to the heart of it. Now,
okay.
I understand what you're saying about the perception of the Russians as we encroach closer to their borders, literally. And I think we should be cognizant of that and react accordingly. It's not because we don't want to give offense. It's because we don't want to needlessly start hostilities. But at the same time, when we make a deal with the Lithuanias of the world and we include Poland in NATO, no one believes that we're taking those countries over, right? Now, and look, and that comes from a perspective when I say, hey, when we go into Iraq, I know we're not quote-unquote taking it over, but we are doing it for our own financial interests. I understand that, or at least the financial interests of the so-called American companies that are going to profit from that, right? So I understand all of that. But when Putin actually does go into Crimea, he does literally take it over. He has annexed it. And so, and it's not, if it was just Crimea, you might say, well, you're right, Crimea is historically more Russian, and Khrushchev gave it to the Ukrainians for political reasons at the time, and perhaps that didn't make quite as much sense given the demographics of Crimea. But when you look at Georgia and you look at Crimea and I know this is a bit of an absurd example, but I think it does give you an insight into what kind of person Putin is. There's an amazing story of when he met Robert Kraft, the owner of the New England Patriots, and Kraft showed him his Super Bowl ring, and Putin just simply took it and put it in his pocket. I mean, is that wrong? Is that an apocryphal story?
I don't know. I know it's very popular on MSNBC. They have a lot of fun with it. They ambush me. I mean, I'm basically persona non grata on MSNBC. But they had me on once, and they trotted out as a preamble to my interview this story. They think it's hilarious. I have not the slightest idea whether it's true or not. But what's true and what's not true is no longer a guiding factor in this kind of American journalism. Nobody fact checks anymore. This is not about Putin. Henry Kissinger said, wisely, whatever else he did in his life, the demonization of Putin is not a policy. It's an alibi for not having a policy. He wrote that in the Washington Post. I would add to that, it's worse, because this demonization of Putin, which has escaped all bounds of logic and fact, has utterly destroyed the capacity of the American policy elite, including the media, to analyze Russian policy. I would argue that American coverage of Russia today, where it matters, I mean on the policy level, is far worse than it was during the Cold War. I mean, I was a regular in the American mainstream media. I was a paid, well-paid consultant on camera and off to CBS News for 20 years. And I remember the debates we had, and I remember the amount of time put in establishing accuracy. So many things that are simply not factually true appear in the mainstream media. I don't know where to begin. One example is this Georgian war. I mean, there were agreements struck, international observers established by the United Nations in the border territory between Russia and Georgia. Saakashvili, the president of Georgia, launched a mortar attack on sleeping civilians in that town and killed international observers. What was Russia supposed to do? Nothing? Imagine if that happened in Mexico. Imagine if somebody in Mexico launched an attack on American border guards so people could come across the Rio Grande. It's a bizarre example. But stop and think what would happen if this was happening on American borders.
So you gotta.
Context is everything. I mean, you can't just take an episode out and say, "Look, it's aggression." I think the real question you asked, if you'll forgive me, the valid question, is not Crimea, because there is no historian who will tell you today that Crimea didn't belong in Russia. And in fact, the Russian government had been negotiating with the Ukrainian government since the end of the Soviet Union in 1991 about whether it should stay territorially in Ukraine or go back to Russia. And then they got bored with it and they dropped it, and then crap happened. The real question is what you asked about countries like Lithuania who want to be in NATO. Do they have a right to choose to be in NATO? You asked that at the beginning, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
I'm going to give you an answer that's going to sound like utter total heresy, but it's complete common sense. No, they do not have a right. Because NATO is not a sorority. It's not a fraternity. It's a security organization. And the bottom line of a security organization is, does this increase or decrease security for its members? And some of us warned from the beginning that when you brought all these little nations in to NATO, they would stop negotiating with Russia, this big bear on their borders. They would stop using diplomacy. And it would lead to more and more confrontation. And the proof is in today's pudding. It's the expansion of NATO in the name of security that's led to the worst security conference, I gather you're a young man, of your lifetime. The whole question, and by the way, we promised Russia when we expanded NATO that we would never build any forward military bases in these new countries. That's exactly what we're doing while you and I talk. And the hawks in NATO have been waiting for this opportunity for decades to violate that agreement. So, no, what is a security organization? So, it's supposed to make everybody safer, and step by step, it's eroded. And one other thing, stop and think what Obama, who seems to have the dimmest historical knowledge of any of this, says things that makes his advisors, if he has any, shudder. I voted for him twice, by the way, so this is not malice on my part. But, I mean, stop and think exactly what's happening in Europe today. Europe, which is supposed to be pro-American, is splitting down the middle because of the American-driven policies toward Ukraine. One unintended consequence of this crisis may well be a profound split in NATO and in the European Union. Slovakia, these are the new countries, by the way, they came in. Slovakia, Hungary, the Czech Republic, Romania, and possibly Bulgaria, because of what happened with the oil pipe deal yesterday, may break with the hardliners in NATO and reaccommodate themselves to Russia. I mean, this is, I assure you, a historic moment of change in Europe. The new Cold War may split Europe the way it was before. Now, that's a bit of a stretch, but the tendencies are there.
So, I want to get back to whether there is aggression or not by the Russians, okay. or if they're just simply reacting. Right. But you brought up something there I've got to ask you a further question on. So you mentioned the hawks inside NATO. And look, the hawks inside the United States have taken over completely. That's why you see the media that you do. We're always right. Any slight perceived transgression against us requires us to go ballistic, literally, right? And we overreact to everything. And And I know the gains that the hawks have in places like Iraq, whether it's the defense contractors, the oil companies, speculators, financial speculators, etc. But I'm not quite as sure as to what the hawks gain by picking a fight with Russia. So what's your sense of that? Why do you think that they're what are the goals of the hawks, whether they're in NATO or the U.S.?
Well, the first obligation of a scholar, like a medical doctor, is when he or she doesn't know, to say they don't know. And I'm not clear exactly what the American and European hawks expect to gain from this confrontation with Russia. But let me back up and say that you articulated in your way my analysis. Then each of the leading countries in this crisis, in the United States, in Brussels, where the European Parliament and Union are, in NATO, in Ukraine, and even in Russia, there are with hawk parties. We know the leaders of the America. That's Senator McCain, and these Republicans are about to take over the Senate. There's a hawk party in Moscow that thinks Putin's been a wuss, that he's appeased. They should just take Kiev in 24 hours and get this over with. Mm-hmm. There's a hawk party in Germany. And by the way, the split in Germany is public now. German newspapers are reporting the divisions in Merkel's own cabinet between her and her foreign minister. Obviously, France is split. So you've got the hawks. What do they want? What do they want? Well, I think, I mean, we call them neocons in America. But they're not really neocons. It's an alliance between the liberal interventionists, which Clinton created when he bombed Serbia in 1999, and his proteges now work for Obama, Susan Rice, Samantha Powers. These are liberal Democrats, but they formed an alliance with the McCains. It's a very powerful factor in American political life. And their counterparts exist in these other countries. One thing that I am told by people who think about this, but I don't know, is that Russia under Putin is in their way. He's in their way, for example, today in Syria, where they want to be rid of Assad. I don't know why they want to be rid of Assad. He stands between radical Islamic control of Syria. He right. fights it. But I don't quite understand what they're thinking. But we saw this confrontation with Russia in Iraq. Russia was against the American invasion of Iraq. Russia was in our way. We brushed them aside. We saw it in Libya. You remember where in Libya we promised the Russians that if they agreed to a no-fly zone over Libya, which meant that those airplanes would not be offensive, they would just keep Gaddafi's planes from leaving the airstrips. Mm-hmm. And in fact, we used them to essentially assassinate Gaddafi. We broke our word to Russia. We brushed Russia aside. Russia has said repeatedly, Russia has an idea, a serious idea. Every time we do regime change in an Islamic country, we bring to power worst elements that we cannot control. Is that true? It's true in Egypt. It's true in Libya. It's going to be true in Iraq if ISIS prevails. Russia is saying you're unleashing madness on the world. Stop. And the neocons, who see their mission as to remove these regimes, sees Putin in the way. Now, you would say, well, why wasn't this the case back in the 90s? Because Russia was weak and was led by a man who was weak, Yeltsin. And then came Putin, and they see him as being in the way. That is a plausible explanation, but there's surely more to it than that. There's the fact that NATO has no real mission anymore. I mean, is it supposed to be an organization that fights in Afghanistan, another war we're about to lose, and leave the mess with Russia, which is near Afghanistan, leaving the heroin and the terrorism, all the stuff and the repression that we said we'd clean up, we're going to leave. I'm not sure we're going to leave, but we're supposed to leave. And they're leaving it to Russia to deal with. Right. So Russia's point of view is that we're creating a danger in the world that affects them. And the hawks, of course, see Russia is in the way of the rightful American. I mean, I guess it comes down to this expression that I guess Madeleine Albright used, but Obama's used it, that America is the indispensable nation. What does that mean? That means that we have the last word in every conflict in the world. That's God's job, not ours. So there are, you mentioned economic factors. I don't know. You mentioned them. I didn't. There are markets and weapons to be sold. Some people think it's about energy. Mm-hmm. Russia has tremendous energy resources. Russia's in our way. Cut Russia down to size.
Right. So
probably, you know what, when things this big happen, like the Vietnam War, or even Iraq, it's never one thing. Mm-hmm. It's a bunch of people with a lot of lousy ideas who decide to band together and produce a really terrible idea. I think that's what happened here.
Well,
I'll tell you what the bottom line is, and I want the younger people to listen to me. If they care about American national security, it runs through Moscow. There is not a single threat to our well-being that can be solved without a partnership with the Kremlin. Putin sits in the Kremlin and will for the foreseeable future. And I'm talking about climate change. I'm talking about nuclear proliferation. I'm talking about the danger of using nuclear arsenals that we have, international terrorism, regional disputes. Not one can be resolved to our benefit without Russia. And therefore, the geniuses in Washington decided to completely alienate Putin.
Right.
I mean, who got Assad to destroy his chemical weapons? Putin. And he gave it to Obama, who was hanging by a toe, if you remember.
Mm-hmm.
His presidency in shatters, is rejected by his own parliament and own party in the Congress. Who gave him a way out? Putin. And what did Obama give him in return?
Yeah, no, I understand all that. And Professor Cohen, I'm sympathetic to almost everything you said there. And we have huge swaths of agreement on that. And look, you say it's a combination of bad ideas that leads to a terrible idea in the case of Iraq. But again, it depends on your perspective. If you're Halliburton and your stock price went up fivefold during the Iraq War, you didn't think it was a bad idea. You thought it was a spectacular idea. So it's a combination of factors, to be sure. But
you're going there, not me. I don't know.
No, I know.
I'm not sure about economic and profit motivations. I know they're there.
I'm sure.
But
okay.
Does the White House really sit down and think, well, Cheney's paycheck's a little low today, so we got to get Halliburton a new market?
No. It's much more complicated and nuanced than that, right? But just because it's nuanced doesn't mean that economic factors are not playing a role.
They're playing a role.
Right, and they play a huge systemic role. And it's the way that it's taken over the body politic is systemic. Now, okay.
Does that mean that we should be mindful that there's shale gas in eastern Ukraine?
Well, I think we should be mindful of it. Again, the issue is probably more complicated than that because the fact that it exists there is not a matter of whether Ukraine controls it, Russia controls it, or the U.S. controls it. It's a matter of which corporation gets the profit from it. So that'll play a larger role in my estimation. And could that be one of the factors involved in this conflict? Of course it could. Money speaks louder than anything else in this country, and the Supreme Court has literally said that. Money is speech, and it could drown out all of our speech, and it has, right? So that's a different set of factors there. But I did want to finish the conversation, at least in regards to the aggression, whether it's real or not, of Russia, right? And on that note, I've got to bring in two things here. So first of all, the Russians feel like, okay, the Serbs are on our side. We will protect them. But the Serbs were wrong in Kosovo. I believe that we were right in intervening in Kosovo. I think we did a lot of good in intervening in Kosovo. So I don't think it's just a matter of whether you intervene or you don't intervene. Honestly, I think it's a silly question. The question is where, how, what are the what's the context, what are the circumstances? And when you mention this idea of the Russian-speaking peoples, well, there are Russian-speaking peoples all across that area, including in Estonia, right? Significant parts of that country, right?
Yes.
So
to
me, that's a very dangerous idea because we all know that that's also what the Germans said. We're just going to protect the German-speaking people of Poland, right, and Czech and the people that lived in other countries in that region. So when I hear of ethnic people being protected, I worry because that is often an excuse used to annex more and more territory. Is that not a legitimate concern?
It is a legitimate concern, but let's put it in context. There is no analogy between Putin and Hitler. That's where that leads, none. No serious historian is going to say they're comparable. There's not a fascist bone in Putin. There are fascists in Russia, but they're not in Putin. In fact, Khodorkovsky, I don't know if you people remember him, he was the oil tycoon in Russia whom Putin put in jail for 10 years and then released last December. He wrote an article saying Putin is probably the most European man in Russia. And he's right. This is a man who speaks fluent German, who's studying English and is said to speak it well. The fact that he was a KGB officer doesn't mean a thing. Many of the best and the brightest in the old Soviet system went into the old KGB, especially the foreign services, not the goofballs who trailed me around when I was living there for 18 years. And I could see them lurking, and they were comical. But the smart guys went into the KGB because they were the best and the brightest, and the KGB wasn't a censorship organization in foreign services. They were into facts and reports. So, you know, the rebirth of ultranationalism, and not just in Russia, but in Ukraine and across Europe, is a fact of our time. It isn't like Hitler, but it's new and it's dangerous. But this question of protecting Russian speakers abroad, remember what happened. When the Soviet Union broke up in 1991, and I need to fact-check this, so I put a footnote to be fact-checked, approximately 20 million ethnic Russians found themselves abroad, living in the Baltic countries, in Romania, in Ukraine, in Central Asia. This was never much of a serious problem until the Ukrainian crisis began, and in my reckoning, provoked by the West, the policymakers who decided on this unwise policy should have stopped and said, if Russia feels obliged to protect Russian speakers in Ukraine, and they might because the border is the same, I can't begin to tell you how much intermarriage there is between Russian and Ukrainians. I never met a Russian who didn't have a Ukrainian mom or dad or grandpa or grandma. How many young couples my wife and I know who are Russians and Ukrainians married together? This is a barricade in the heart of a family. Russia was bound to react. But somebody should have asked, well, would Russia grow worried or bellicose or aggressive regarding less but many ethnic Russians living in Estonia, for example? And if the answer had been yes, then the conclusion might have been, maybe we better not pursue this policy. And there's a footnote here. Russia has appealed repeatedly to the United Nations, protesting that the Baltic countries, including Estonia, are in violation of international norms by refusing to give ethnic Russians the right to vote in these Baltic countries. They've rigged the electoral system. They're in violation of the United Nations' own laws. And when Russia brings it to the Security Council, the United States vetoes it. So there are, again, two sides
of
this
story. That's very frustrating. And you're right that there are two sides to that story. And for example, in Estonia, there are even more abuses of the Russian minorities.
And you have a rise of, stop and think. Russia lost 27 Union lost 27 million citizens in World War II. Every family is missing somebody. People are getting old, but grandpa, grandma never survived. Husbands never came home. Kids grew up as orphans. It's an open wound, World War II. And when they see people running around with Nazi regalia in the Baltics and in Ukraine and even in Kiev and even in the fighters in these so-called battalions in the east, Russia's going to react. The first obligation of a policymaker is the same as a doctor, the Hippocratic Oath. Do no harm. Stop and think about the consequences. Nobody stopped and thought. Now, maybe for the reasons you suggest, the motives, but the Obama administration inherited this problem, and it's made it worse. And here's the problem, except for the conversation you and I are having tonight, you cannot hear this discussed in the United States. And that's a scandal. That's a bad on American democracy. And it was never like this before. And when you don't discuss it, things get worse. And that's why I am worried.
I can't help but ask one more question. What if Putin was to go into one of those Baltic countries and say, well, I've got a Russian-speaking minority here I've got to protect. They're not getting their voting rights, et cetera. What would you have us do?
Well, according to Article 5, or is it 6? I think it's 5, of NATO. Because Estonia is a member of NATO, all of the NATO countries would have to undertake war against Russia. That's the rule. What would actually happen? I don't know. But does anybody want to play with that fire?
But what would
anyway,
you have us
let's back off. Why? I mean, Russia has enormous economic problems. Putin wants to go down in history as the man who modernized Russia. That's been his goal from the beginning. Why does he want more economic or military grief? I mean, he's already got stuck with an utterly destroyed eastern Ukraine, which the Kiev government has used cluster and other illegal weapons to destroy. 60% of the coal mines in eastern Ukraine are shut by war, destroyed. I mean, The Ukrainian government just announced a few days ago it's no longer going to pay pensions to people who had earned them in eastern Ukraine, and it's shutting down all the bank accounts. So people are going to starve. All that goes on the Russian bill now, plus Crimea. What in the world would Putin want Estonia for? What in the world?
Okay, well, so that's that. Look, I think we still have that disagreement. Professor Cohen, but I think that my estimation of Putin is different than yours. I mean, you say there's not a fascist bone in his body. It depends on what you mean by fascism. But, I mean, he's done assassinations abroad.
No, he hasn't. Well, wait a minute. That means you just...
Come on. No,
who's he assassinated?
The former Russian government official that was in London.
Oh, you think so? Well, then tell me this. I mean, this is where you got to get your facts. If he was assassinated by Putin, why won't Scotland Yard release the autopsy report?
Well,
the Russians have asked for
a number of reasons, because then they're put in a difficult position of going and trying to do something about it, which they don't want to do.
Well, they keep having hearings, but Scotland Yard will not release the autopsy report. Do you know one valid reason why it might be? Because this guy, his name was Litvinenko, had so much plutonium in it, not plutonium, polonium in his body, that he couldn't possibly have ingested that much unless he was carrying it around and it was leaking. There is nobody serious. You know how this story got started? There was a Russian oligarch whom Putin had chased to London named Berezovsky. He killed himself a few months ago, who had a powerful press agency in London and got the story, because Litvinenko had worked for him, that Putin had assassinated him. I know the guy who wrote Litvinenko's deathbed accusation against Putin. It was in perfect English. Litvinenko barely spoke English. This is a preposterous story. Let me give you the other case that's probably on your mind. There was a wonderful Russian journalist named Anya Polakovskaya, mm-hmm. who was shot dead in her apartment building 7 years ago. She was a friend of ours. She was in my apartment. She was a friend of my wife's. Her editor, who still runs the newspaper, Novaya Gazeta, was her dearest mentor and protector. They grieve her to the day. Not one of those people think Putin was behind that assassination, though he's routinely accused of it.
But
these are stories that are pumped into the press, and
Professor Cohen, the list goes on and on, and then taking away some degree of democracy from the local governors in Russia.
Okay, that happened. That's absolutely true. Now you got facts.
Okay, and then when you talk about jailing what appear to be his political opponents, now you can argue about the merits of the cases, but to the naked eye, again, it appears that he's a guy who's disagreeing with Putin, and all of a sudden there's charges.
Let me ask you a question.
This is what Erdogan does in Turkey as well. We've seen this power play before.
That's the way leaders of great powers act. Let's not go around. If that would lead us into how many governments the United States has overthrown since, say, in the last 20 years, how many countries we've invaded.
But I'm opposed to that as well.
But let me give you an example. Let me be a professor for a moment. it's true that Putin ended the popular election of governors in Russia. That's true. However, it is also true that two democracies, at least two, France and India, do not appoint governors. Theorists of democracy have a debate about whether governors should be elected or appointed. We elect them in the United States, but other democracies do not. It wasn't working out in Russia because of the corruption in the provinces. So this is a debate. This isn't an accusation. Even democracies do things differently. I mean, we have an electoral college, which some people think is undemocratic. These should be matters of analysis, not indictment. Do you see what I'm getting at?
Now, I understand that, but when you total all these things together, it paints a picture of a guy who, as you say, is strong and aggressive, and you say he stands up for Russian interests, and I understand that, and there's a lot of truth in that. But part of his perception of standing up for Russian interests is going to stand up for Russian minorities or ethnic compatriots in other people's territory. So, look, if he goes into Estonia and takes a part of Estonia, will you come back on the show and say, perhaps I calculated his interests a little wrong?
You're asking me to analyze a hypothetical. I mean, the idea that Putin... we got a plane flying overhead at the moment, okay, probably looking for one of us. The trouble with analyzing hypotheticals is you have to sit here and imagine what all the conditions may be. Let us say that this forward base that we're now building in Estonia on Russia's borders, that somebody gets drunk and shoots five Russian soldiers on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And Russia sends a squad into Estonia to clean that nest out. I don't know. I mean, what my reaction would be. One would have to see the circumstances. These hypotheticals. Here's what we can say. And it's a long discussion, and we don't have the time. And it's good we disagree. But speaking as a Russian historian who's written biographies of Russian leaders, but who was also deeply involved in the democratic dissident movement in the Soviet Union, who lived among them, I'm disappointed by what's happened inside Russia to its politics. I'm disappointed. Do I think Putin is to blame? I think he's partially to blame. But all this began under Yeltsin, when the system became so corrupt through privatization that any leader who had inherited this system would have been authoritarian. Has Putin been too authoritarian? Probably. At home, probably he has. But in international affairs, Putin has been, and I'm going to try to frame this so nobody begins denouncing me for this, but historians will look back and say that Putin is the towering statesman internationally of the first part of the 20th century, the greatest. Now, great could mean bad or good. We're not judging him. Mm-hmm. But he has been an enormously successful international statesman until this crisis began. As for his badness, let's remember one thing. When we were attacked on 9/11, he was the first and only leader to call President Bush and say, George, whatever you want, I'm with you. And what he gave the United States in its land war in Afghanistan, where we chased the Taliban out of Kabul, saved hundreds of American lives. It's another story. Because of Putin today, if you have any relatives fighting in Afghanistan, or your viewers and listeners do, they get their supplies, medical supplies, military supplies, because Putin allows them to be transported over and through Russia, because Pakistan has become too dangerous. It was Putin who voted for harsher sanctions against Iran 3 years ago, against its nuclear program. And it was Putin who got rid of chemical weapons in Syria. So if you're going to evaluate Putin as a friend or foe of America, there's a balance sheet. And you might draw it differently than I do. But you got to get people to acknowledge that there's a balance sheet, that you got to sort it out, and that this demonization has just destroyed analysis. And when you get rid of analysis, you usually end up in a war.
All right. Professor Stephen Cohen, professor of Russian studies and history at New York University and the author of Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives from Stalinism to the New Cold War. This was an excellent conversation. We thank you for joining us on the Young Turks and really, really enjoyed it and appreciated it. Thank you.
Well, I thank you, and I followed you for years, and I'm glad you're back in action.
Thank you so much.